Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is August 10th, 2016, and I am really pleased to have back with me today James Howard Kunstler, who is the author, extraordinary writer, blogger, you name it, all-around guy, speaker, goes out and it tells the world the things that I've been trying to say in his own wonderful, wonderful style. And of course, he's been doing it longer than I have. One of the very first books that I came across that really caught me and put the dots together in a way that I understood was The Long Emergency. Just a fantastic, fantastic read. And taking that tour of the data, as it were, that's in The Long Emergency that explains the predicaments we face. He's also got another series of books in The World Made by Hand, which is a fictional account of what the world might or will look like once The Long Emergency really begins to get underway. So with that, James, really happy to have you back with me today.
It's a pleasure, Chris. Oh. And you forgot to say that I bake cookies and make my own clothes.
Well,
and come in 9 decorator colors.
Yeah, if you your long underwear series, I hear, is just not to be missed.
That's next.
Well, so where do we start on this? So Jim, it's been a while, and you know, you and I have had some offline conversations by phone, and I wish people could have been listening in, because you and I are out there doing what we can to interface with the world and let it know what we think is coming and to engage in the conversations. And I'm discovering that people are getting nervous, that there's a little bit more ability to engage in conversations. And here's one quick example. 5 years ago, nobody would believe me. It was a very small crowd of people who understood that these election machines are very easily hacked and that elections are easily stolen. In fact, they are. Of course they are. If you can get away with something that has that much at stake, you're probably going to rig it. Of course they've been rigged. The data was always there. It wasn't a question of shortage of material, information, data, evidence. All of this could have been laid out prosecutorially and very easily, a very easy case to win. But people still weren't ready to go there, and now people are ready to go there. Now more people are going, huh, I guess that might be true. And so I'm finding that we're in this weird moment in time for me where people are at once both kind of worn down by the larger experience of life. Like, nothing really seems to be breaking. Maybe it's just going to go this way forever. And simultaneously, understanding that things are getting further and further off the rails and things could really go pear-shaped. And so I'm finding that tension out there right now. So just now that I have you and the record button's on, I would just love to talk about your experience in that regard.
Well, the dynamics you're describing, I think, really are, for the most part, the financial and economic dynamics that we pay a lot of attention to. But, you know, if you want to see something that's really flying apart, all you have to do is look at the gruesome spectacle of the 2016 presidential election. What's happening with Trump is just unbelievable. The guy, I have to be clear that I'm not fond of either of these candidates. I'm very disenchanted and disappointed with both of the major parties and their candidates. But Trump is especially just an amazing case of somebody completely out of control, who just doesn't seem to be able to get his, his whole lower half of his body out of his mouth. And I am beginning to wonder, I've been wondering for a while if, you know, behind the scenes, all these Republicans are not running around with their hair on fire, trying to find some device, some way to get rid of him, you know, to dump him, to do something. My thought today is, you know, an outside possibility that in desperation, they might just turn to, you know, supporting the Libertarian ticket of Gary Johnson and Bill Weld. But, I mean, that's kind of a low percentage deal, but you never know. On the Hillary side, there are three things about Hillary that I think are kind of salient at the moment. One is this gathering question about her health. You know,
right?
She seems to have some peculiar health problems. People are speculating about, you know, some kind of brain convulsion seizure problem, and who knows? You know, that remains unresolved and deeply kind of hidden and stuffed down. The other thing is that, you know, with all the noise about her email scandal, the one thing that we're not really getting a whole lot of information about, which I think is really the vital thing, is the connection between her State Department email server activities and the activities of the Clinton Foundation in grubbing money from donors all around the world, especially donors in countries doing business with the State Department in one way or another, you know, getting approvals for arms sales and things like that. The dearth of reportage about that is really stunning, and the dearth of inquiry from, you know, supposedly responsible authorities. Another thing that's ought to be really troubling is the advocacy of major media outlets like the New York Times and CNN. And there was one story today in the New York Times that was just stupefyingly weird. It was about the difficulty that Hillary and Bill supposedly had when Bill lost the governorship of Arkansas in 1980. He had served one term. They had two-year terms. He got unreelected. And so the New York Times story was, here are these two poor people who are coming out of government, and they're used to living in the governor's mansion, and now all of a sudden they don't have jobs, and they don't have any money, and they have to buy a house in a crummy neighborhood, and isn't that sad? And I'm thinking, okay, you have two Yale-educated lawyers, one of them a former governor, and they can't get jobs at a decent law firm somewhere in the South or anywhere else. I mean, it was preposterous that, you know, this sob story that we're supposed to believe they couldn't make a living. You know, how many ex-governors can get seats on, you know, university boards of directors, corporate boards of directors, you know, and get paid stupefyingly large sums of money just for doing nothing or attending three meetings a year. So
this was back in the 80s, right?
Yeah. This was the Time story was about what happened in the 80s when Bill did not get reelected.
Well, now this they should have just turned back to Hillary's extraordinary abilities as a cattle futures trader, where she did turn $1,000 into $100,000. Wink, wink. We know how that happened.
Yeah.
In the futures market. So yeah. But your larger point.
My larger point is
the sob story. Like, oh, we have to humanize these people. How do we make them just like everybody?
Right.
Poor ex-governors.
But how credulous do they think their readers are? You know, that we're going to feel sorry for them, you know, that they couldn't get a job.
It's ridiculous. You know, there's an astonishing thing I'm noticing where for whatever reason, when politics get involved, it's like people revert to team sports. They're not aware that there's just a different uniform on one versus the other. Like, oh no, the Jets, I hate the Bills. You know, it's just this whole craziness. Right.
Yeah.
But I've seen a lot of people come out with this canard that Hillary's just getting really a bad deal in the press because she's a woman, right? That's the meme they're trying to trot out. And I'm thinking, no, she's getting less than a bad deal because they're not actually talking about all the stuff she's done. If she's getting a bad deal at all, it's because those are the decisions and choices she made in life to do some really awful things. I really am very much against this whole idea of trying to say that sexism has a role in this or racism has a role, all these things which are just divisive elements. How about we just talk about who the people are, what they've done, what their records are, and can we start there? Because she's got, in my mind, a horrible record, just horrible.
Well, two things about that. One is that to get back to the larger point we were on a few minutes ago, that the disorders in politics that we're seeing now are really expressions of the larger disorders in our economic life and our financial life.
Yeah.
And that just happens to be the avenue that the expression is coming out of. The second point, or another point I'd like to make, is that the reason that people are against Hillary or dumping on Hillary or don't like her is because she's a poster child for racketeering, mm-hmm. and for political racketeering. And I encourage people who are talking about our circumstances and people who are interested in the news and the election to use the word racketeering to describe what's going on in this country, because it, you know, you really need the right vocabulary to understand exactly what's going on. Racketeering is just pervasive in all of our activities, not just in politics, but even in things like medicine and education. You know, obviously, you know, the college loan scheme is an example of racketeering. And anybody who has to go to an emergency room with a child who's broken their finger or something is going to end up with a bill for $20,000. You know why? Because of medical racketeering. And so, you know, these are really efforts to money grub by any means necessary, often in ways that are unethical and probably illegal. So let's use that word racketeering to describe our national situation.
Sure, let's absolutely do that. I remember reading, it was probably back in 2011, a Matt Taibbi article about Occupy Wall Street, and they had just come up with some money, and he was at a party or some event, and this person was like, isn't that ironic? Those Occupy Wall Street people are putting that money in a bank. And he said, it's not ironic, they're not anti-bank. They're anti-corruption in the banking system. But the meme got out there that, oh, these people must just be anti-bank, and somehow the whole message gets corrupted. But really, this larger thing that we're seeing in the United States, we're seeing it in France, we're seeing it across big swaths of Europe. If you haven't been reading what's going on in Greece, it's really going on there. People, average, ordinary people are getting squeezed. And getting squeezed harder and harder. So forget all the headline statistics about, oh, we had 200,000 new jobs created and wage growth has been fantastic. It's not fantastic, particularly not compared to the actual rate of inflation. And here's, Jim, here's my larger view of this, which is held, and I think this holds well, is that if you want to understand an economy, you have to understand how much energy it's using.
And sure.
There's a lot of energy flowing through it. Of course, you can have a dynamic economy. Who knows what creative people will do with all that energy? They'll drive to soccer games or they'll, you know, build giant things. Who knows?
Well energy that's affordable.
Affordable, but let's look at it in terms of energy per capita. How much energy do you have going per person? And the United States had rising energy per capita up to about 1970 because we had all this petroleum, and then our petroleum peaked. And ever since then, we've had declining net oil per capita or energy per capita. And on a net basis, even worse because of what we know about energy return on energy invested. So let's just compare, like if this main thesis holds, which says, gosh, just track the amount of energy going through and you will understand the larger shape and context of a culture. The United States, by this model, we would say, well, something in the average person's experience would have peaked around 1970-ish and would be going downhill ever since. And I don't mean in terms of Pokemon Go and wonderful smartphones and all that stuff. Obviously, technology's advanced. But you could support a family on a single income in the 1970s. I remember because not that I was supporting a whole household, but I was actually working for minimum wage, much lower on an hourly basis compared to today nominally. But I could actually put money aside. Today, there would be no chance of surviving on minimum wage. Now, in fact, two wage earners on minimum wage, forget about it. It's still almost impossible in most places, thoroughly impossible in many metropolitan markets. So by this measure, we would predict that things are just generally getting harder and harder. So that's thrust one. I think that's in play. Things, you know, affordable energy is on its way out the door. And of course, that's adding some pressures to this. But then you have to combine it with the racketeering you're talking about, where the people in charge can't help themselves, almost like rats who can detect the ship's about to sink. I don't know. They grab everything they can. And so the thieving, the money grubbing, the grabbing that's going on is a hurricane force of vacuuming from the bottom to the top. And then, you know, the gatekeepers, which is the New York Times and et al., are busy trying to pretend as if this is just a thing that happens. Why are people so cranky? You know, let's not do the class war thing. It's so inappropriate. But the truth of the matter is that the elites are overstaying their welcome. They don't understand noblesse oblige for starters, but they don't even understand the basics of that there needs to be some fairness in a society for it to be livable. And I think that's escaped them.
Well, it's a very demoralized society now. And that, I think, is one of the only things that might explain the failure of people of stature arising out of the elites to make some kind of credible opposition to what's going on. I mean, aside from Bernie Sanders, can there be only one guy, one figure in America who, you know, wants to take a stand against what's been going on? And let's remember, by the way, that the activities of the central banks is just another form of racketeering, using debt issuance and attempting to control interest rates in order to conceal our inability to generate the kind of real wealth that we need to continue as a techno-industrial society. So I actually do think that there, you know, that the human project has the capacity to produce people of goodwill, but there may be a kind of a sine, cosine, wave form that, you know, that explains that at certain times in history, societies have a real hard time understanding what they're doing, you know, articulating the problems that they face and coming up with a coherent consensus about what's happening and coming up with a coherent consensus about what to do about it. And that's one of the quandaries we're in. You know, the other quandary, which you are painfully aware of course, is the relationship between energy and the debt racket for concealing our lack of real capital formation. And, you know, I like to reduce it to one particular formula that is pretty easy for people to understand. You know, it's a classic quandary, and that is that oil priced at over $75 a barrel in today's dollars tends to crush economies, and oil priced under $75 a barrel in today's dollars tends to crush oil companies. And, you know, there is no real sweet spot between those two places. And we you know, we're ratcheting between them, and each one of them entails a lot of destruction. So that's a terrible quandary we're in. And it's being expressed in banking and finance. And the people in charge of those things don't really know what else to do except to continue the deformation of institutions and instruments.
You know, we've been talking at our site at Peak Prosperity for a while about some of the ecological signs that are out there. And one of the things that sort of caught our attention for a while was talking about insects. And, yeah. You know, my observation was that when I was a boy, you know, in the woody station wagon, we would drive from Connecticut to upstate New York and across, you know, Route 90 there and the New York State Thruway. And I remember every time we stopped for gas, somebody would have to get out and just scrape the bugs off. Like you just couldn't see anymore, you know?
Sure.
And we just made the trip recently in July and drove the whole way there. Not a single bug on the windshield, not one. Right.
Yeah.
And of course there's all this data coming out of Germany and other places and the guy who does the soundscape, he's been dutifully recording very specific locations with high fidelity microphones for 30 years and just saying it's, you know, there's just this collapse of sound. He calls it the deafening walls of silence on his recordings now. So this is all happening around us, and it takes a minimal sort of awareness, I think, to A, notice that that's happening, and then B, say there's maybe we should look at that. That's actually an important sign, we think. This generalized loss of species, you know, it's like a rapture has happened, only it wasn't humans, it was insects, you know, that got taken. Whoops.
Yeah.
You know, that there's this general, really big giant stuff happening ecologically. And, we can't summon the attention for it because we're just too distracted with maintaining the fictitions, if I can make up a word, of our current environment, what you call, you know, the happy motoring utopia. This is what I feel in the Hillary campaign and to a lesser extent in the Trump campaign, but in other political movements, is just this desperation to maintain the status quo. Because I think what's happening, Jim, is that will allow people to not have to confront what's actually happening. It feels like a last gasp at reality ignoring or something like that.
I think it's very, very hard emotionally. I mean, it's hard for me. I can barely stand to read stories in the press about what's happening to the oceans, you know, what's happening in mass extinctions. And, you know, you, I think, especially as somebody coming out of the hard biological sciences, you know, you have a particular appreciation for this, and you're probably more able to give your attention to it than maybe, you know, me or some other ordinary person. But I just find it so sad. I can barely think about what's happening to the oceans. And I understand that, you know, that other people can't either. That's one of the things that they, you know, we can't grapple with at the moment. And I'm not sure we're going to be able to do anything about it. Although I do think that in the larger sense, reality always has mandates of its own, and circumstances are eventually going to compel us to do things differently. Circumstances will change the situation for us. You know, we'll probably be dragged kicking and screaming into the recognition of the predicament that we're in. But we're not going to let go of it voluntarily. And, you know, there are ways of understanding that. You know, one of my favorite ways is understanding the psychology of previous investment. The idea, you know, that's also another way of expressing sunk costs, right? You know, the idea that you've put so much of your personal wealth or cultural, national wealth in a certain infrastructure for daily life that you can't imagine letting go of it. And that's kind of where we're at.
I completely agree. And I have a confession to make, which is that, you know, for all the time I spend talking about these giant predicaments, I actually love my own life. The life I've fashioned for myself. I hope it's not a case of fiddling while Rome burns a little bit, you know, but I believe that I have to walk the talk, that I have to be the change I want to see. But more importantly, I actually really like gardening, and I like building soil, and I like being in relationship with all the insects, not just the bees and butterflies I plant for, but I like to, I really think that this is the thing I've been wrestling with. So I did a lot of sort of existential introspection over my summer vacation. And here's what really came to me. It's that, you know, we had this set of institutions that served us pretty well for a while in the hunter-gatherer time. And then there was this big switch over, and we went into agrarian pursuits, which, you know, mixed results. And we'll see how that whole experiment turns out. But fundamentally, that the institutions that arose during that time were fundamental. They were extractive. And right now, I was just reading a book called Why Nations Fail and interviewed the author. And great book. And it posited this idea that some nations are poor and some are rich, not because of geography, not culture, none of that. It's because they had the right political institutions that were inclusive and the right economic institutions that were also inclusive. But if the political institutions were in any way marginalizing or exclusive to elites, and the economic institutions were also that way, like you can imagine, like Mexico, Carlos Slim, second or first most wealthy person in the world, depending on which day we're counting, he got there because he got the telephone contract out of the Mexican government, and because he knew the right people, and so there was that lack of inclusivity. There would be no way for an average Mexican person to compete against him and get a loan from the banking system there. It's not possible because it's not how it's structured. So that was the explanation of this book, was like, well, you know, if you have these extractive political and economic institutions, you end up with poor nations. But look, ta-da, if you get these shiny, wonderful examples where you have these wealthy nations, that's the United States, et cetera. And so it's an interesting framework. I like it a lot. But what's missing from that, when I asked him this question, is, yes, you know, we have these inclusive political and economic institutions, but they're still extractive. They're just not extractive of humans, right? But they're still extractive of the natural world. And so I think that as much as like capitalism and inclusive political institutions was the wave of one period of time, this next period of time, if we're going to make this transition in any way, shape, or form, when the dust settles, we're going to have new institutions, new cultural institutions. I'm not talking just buildings and, you know, things like, but our new political and cultural and economic institutions that are regenerative and relational, where now it's fairly isolated and extractive. And yeah, I don't know how we get to that point, that second stage, but that's really where my thinking is at this point, is that there's nothing salvageable in most of our institutions because they're founded on a premise that's false, which is that we can extract forever.
Right. And I would reiterate that I think that we will get there, but we'll probably be dragged there kicking and screaming against our will. You know, we'll find ourselves there. One aspect of this that interests me and kind of amazes me is the inability of thinking people, of the thinking classes in our society, and they're still there. Their inability to understand that the institutions of modernity were very special. They were extra special. And so many of these thinking people assume that these institutions are permanent. You know, this is the whole amazingly weird thing behind the Tom Friedman idea that the global economy is a permanent part of the human condition. When in fact, you know, it's obvious that it was the product of a set of very special circumstances during a special time and place, namely the late 20th century in the advanced nations of the world, you know, and two conditions that prevailed, namely about 100 years of relatively very cheap energy and about 70 years of relative peace between the great powers. You know, there was animosity and there was friction, but there were no great world wars for those period, for that period. And, you know, that has allowed a series of economic relations between distant nations to play out. And the idea that these things are permanent, it just strikes me as hilarious and preposterous. And yet that's what we're asked to believe by the, you know, by the avatars of Keynesianism and the New York Times and, you know, the people who want to keep the rackets going.
Indeed. And even if things don't collapse all at once, there's this idea of drift, the institutional drift that happens over time. So what you're talking about is there were some contingencies that sort of had to be in play. Like if for whatever reason we hadn't discovered oil, trust me, this is all a very different sort of a world we're sitting in at this point in time. And the thing that I took from this book as well, though, is that you have to guard the institutions you do have carefully in some respect, because it really matters what's happening in them and whether they're adapting well to the times and or not, right? So right now I can see that, you know, as I add up all my little data points, I say our political institutions are being revealed as increasingly not inclusive. Right. You know, this whole thing that happened, like, it still shocked me to see Bernie toss in the towel, reading the reports I've read that said, look, there was voter suppression, there was voter roll purgings, there was actual outright statistical evidence of vote flipping in the electronically rigged machines, tabulators that were giving out anonymous erroneous results, and also vote tallies that did not match the exit polls. Just all this buffet of crud, you know, that just says stolen election, right? And for him to sort of overlook that and say, yeah, I know you guys had a lot of energy, but we lost fair and square. You know, they stole it fair and square. It was just, it was a little kind of a flat note in that. But what's really missing from that is that he missed on the point there of saying, once you've sort of rolled over and admitted that you have corrupt systems and that's just the way it is, that's actually a really far more important point than just saying, well, this is bigger than just about me, and I guess next election we'll have a shot at fixing this. You don't. Once you institutionalize and accept that level of thievery, which happened in 2000, by the way, this is not about Bernie. I mean, it happened earlier, but these are big moments. These are really, I think, really big, sweeping, fundamental things are happening to the fabric of our country in terms of privacy, the voting issues, the banking. Like you said, they're all rackets. All rackets.
I think it's the essence of the demoralization that you're describing, that we're in a period really where anything goes and nothing matters. And, you know, among the many proofs of that is the fact that the supposed guardians of our collective virtue of right and wrong are disabled. You know, we have institutions like the Securities and Exchange Commission and some of the duties of the Federal Reserve and the Department of Justice, you know, and they were supposed to, you know, take actions. You know, the FBI is supposed to make referrals to the SEC for the prosecution of financial misconduct. You know, all of this stuff is missing. And of course, you can lay a lot of this at the desk of Barack Obama, you know, a really kind of peculiar figure in our history, in our politics, because, you know, he seems to be a decent fellow. He's articulate. He's calm and suave. And, you know, he seems to have personal characteristics that are admirable. And yet he has done absolutely nothing to guard the sense of right and wrong in our institutional life. And I think it's been hugely damaging. And the fact that nobody is able to recognize this, especially among what I call the thinking classes, you know, and in that wad of people, you know, I come out of the old New York liberal democratic part wing of the thinking classes. You know, that's sort of my heritage. I'm completely disenchanted with it. And, you know, I wonder how other people feel about it. I don't really see that disenchantment so much in other people. I see a more general sense of being discouraged and cynicism, you know, which is merely thinking the worst of the human race, which is really not good enough. That's not enough of an emotion to get you forward, get you to anything better. But that's all I see. And, I don't know what it takes to make this right. As I said before, I think it's one of the great abiding mysteries of the last dozen or so years that no figures of stature have stepped forward to oppose this behavior. And that is something that ought to make us very, very concerned, because it tells us that we're going to have to wait until circumstances really whack this society upside the head with a 2x4. You know, to get its attention and you know, make some of the changes we're describing. I do think that we will get to a new disposition of things. I think it's going to be very different from our expectations and very different from the comforts and conveniences that we've enjoyed in the last, you know, 50, 60 years. But I don't think it's going to be all bad. I just think that, you know, people cannot imagine. We just have a kind of national incapacity to imagine the sort of future that we're entering, the reset of economic life especially.
And this has been one of the longest stretches of economic ease, really. I mean, you know, to the extent that somebody's poor in the United States, let's compare them to somebody living 300 years ago, and it's just a king's life, even then.
Flat screen TVs, you know, all the cheese doodles you could ever want to eat. A lot of people who are supposedly poor are definitely not going hungry. I mean, we can tell that from the, you know, the crisis that we see of just the condition of American citizens. You know, they're just in the worst shape of people that you can imagine. I went to Stockholm on a speaking gig in June, and you know, I got off the plane and I noticed that I was in a city full of normal-sized people, and it was like a stupefying experience to all of a sudden be in, you know, in a place where people actually looked like healthy adults. Whereas, you know, I live in a corner of the world, not too different from yours, and we're not that far away from each other, but, you know, I live in kind of an old deindustrialized corner of the upper Hudson Valley where there are very few good jobs, and the remaining population doesn't have that much to do and doesn't get paid very much, and they look terrible. You go into the supermarket and, you know, maybe 5% of the people in the supermarket are not grossly overweight, don't look terribly sick or diabetic or like they're suffering from, you know, vascular problems or, you know, have to lean on some kind of a shopping cart just to walk up the aisle. It's a pretty scary thing to see.
Well, indeed, and you know that you can literally be starving to death while you're packing the weight on with our the food that, air quotes, food that we have in this country. But these are the kinds of things that people do to themselves when they're really just asleep at the switch. I don't know where it starts. You know, we did homeschool our children because I had some concerns about politely, the indoctrination that I think public schools are forced to, enforce at this point in time, ranging from the idea that I've used this anecdote before, but I was talking with somebody and he got in a bit of a tiff with his son's teachers because his son, who was like 9 or something, was with 2 other boys at the back of the recess yard throwing rocks at trees in the wood. And that was violent. And, his son got in trouble and he was just mystified. He's like, think of all the things you learn by throwing, sure. Every rock's differently shaped. You've got gravity involved. There's all this coordination. That's actually an important part of learning. It would be like saying to otters, no playing, or puppies, no tussling with each other. Don't do that. I mean, it's just like a normal part of human development. And we're like, no, we can't even honor normal anything at this point, because we've lost, to me, if I had one phrase, it would be common sense, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, you ask
where it starts, and I think that, the general run of humanity really does need some kind of a coherent armature for daily life, and that includes role models who mm-hmm. offer examples of behavior that, that will allow them to thrive rather than to be defeated by life. They need a certain amount of discipline in order to fulfill the behavior that those role models show them. And they need some aspiration, some ability to aspire lead to the products or the results of leading, what we might call a good life. And a lot of those things are missing, especially in these unfortunately sort of disenfranchised, thrown away, forgotten lower middle classes that we have in America. And I mean, you can see it very clearly in my region, which was, as I said, a former thriving region of small fat manufacturing, small factories. There were like at least 8 or 10 factories around the confluence of the Hudson River and the Battenkill River, where I am. And a lot of these, granted, a lot of these companies were paternalistic, but as part of that paternalism, they sponsored a lot of institutional activities for people. They had baseball teams, they had outings, they paid these people enough money to live decently. These people produced children who aspired to do better, and they were able to do better. They got a better education by the 8th grade in the 1920s than people are getting now in grad schools. And all of this stuff has dissolved. And, you actually need quite a bit of built-in structure in everyday life for a society to thrive and for individuals to thrive within it. And that's not there. And we don't care about it. We just don't care. Have eliminated most of the public gathering places in small town America. I live in a town that doesn't have a coffee shop, a bar, any place that somebody might go outside their home. And there's the expectation that, all of the community, in quotes, that you're going to be a part of is found on your TV set. That's just a lie. And it's based on a very basic and almost universal misunderstanding in America that the virtual is an adequate substitute for the authentic. That having relationships with made up people on TV is the same thing as having relationships with people who are really in your life. And so that structure for leading a good life is absent. And we're seeing the results of it in this anything goes and nothing matters society that we've created for ourselves.
All very well said. And if I could just piggyback on that and say that if I had one wish for any family that would be a big, big boost to their lives, it would be to get rid of the TV. I mean, you could do worse than to start right there. Just getting rid of that box that consumes so many hours. But worse, it's a box that suppresses your own thinking. No thoughts necessary while it's doing the thinking for you. And they are very, very good at what they do with TV now in terms of how messages are crafted and inserted using the latest in neurological understandings and wirings and programming and all that stuff. Anyway, that was one of the greatest things in our lives.
A tremendous act of will for ordinary people to do that. And they would, many of them would be bereft because for one reason or another, they're out of the habit of reading, you know, even the newspaper, which used to be something that working people did, and they don't do that. And then, you know, they're out of the habit of evaluating their own ideas, which gives them very little basis for even understanding what's going on, let alone developing a coherent political viewpoint about things. So it's asking a lot. It doesn't seem to be happening. You know, I wouldn't say that people are out there throwing their flat screen TVs away in any great numbers. And so, you know, the question is, what happens despite that?
I don't know the answer to that, but I will tell you that maybe if it's too much to throw the TV out, turn it off for a week. Or 28 days. That's all it takes. Just,
well,
you know, start
somewhere. Experiment.
And it's an experiment. Because these larger, feels to me that hopefully we're at some sort of a nadir in terms of involvement, right? So whether people are politically involved or culturally involved or involved in their own health or moving around or locally involved or even involved in their garden out back, that level of involvement seems... hopefully at some sort of a low. And mm-hmm. As a quick aside, you know, I was actually, I want to, the contrarian in me wants to deride the Pokemon Go craze and phenomenon, but I'm seeing people go outside, and interact with the outdoor world, which if it has to happen through their phone, great. It's just, I actually think there might be some benefit. I would bet there's going to be more than a couple people that when that craze is over are going to say, you know what, I still like walking around outside.
Well, maybe, but you know, that kind of raises another issue, which is something that I covered in some of my first nonfiction books back in the 90s, and namely The Geography of Nowhere, which was about the deficiencies of the human habitat in America, mm-hmm. and especially the fiasco of suburbia. And I think that, you know, the bottom line is the outside in America is such a degraded place in most places, you know, whether it's, you know, suburban Minneapolis or suburban Dallas or Long Island or Jersey or the Inland Empire out in California. You know, these are places where it's almost impossible for a human being to feel okay neurologically. They're punishing environments. They're psychologically and neurologically punishing. You know, you're around these large machines that are moving at lethal speeds. You're around a tremendous amount of incoherent visual clutter that assaults your brain. You have to traverse these terrible distances, you know, and which, unless you're in a car, you know, it's like going on the Bataan Death March to walk from one mall to the other.
Yep.
You know, nobody except, you know, a person who has nothing, no other way of getting around would do that. And so, you know, we're kind of stuck with the human habitat itself, which is working very poorly. Now, you and I live in the Northeast, and we live in small towns. I think that that's really going to end up being the place that gets rehabilitated first in our daily life, largely because a lot of these places have a meaningful relationship with food production. Many of them in our area, I know here, have a meaningful relationship with hydroelectric or hydropower. Even if you're not going to make electricity, you can do other things with hydro. And I think those two things are tremendously important. I'm beginning to see the signs of what I think will eventually be a upstate New York economy much more focused on agriculture and the activities that support it. Because right now it's not really based on anything except, you know, a lot of people driving 40 miles each way to be janitors in large buildings that probably, you know, can't be sustained in the future. So that economy of, you know, 40-mile janitorial jobs, you can forget about that. That's toast. But what the question is, what is going to be the next economy in these places? And these are the places most suited, I think, to the next economy, the places that have some meaningful relationship with water and growing food.
I certainly agree with that. And, through all of the contrarianism and seeing, you know, the potential looming catastrophes, I do see a lot of the opportunities in this as well. And I'm cheering them on. I actually, you know, I really am looking forward to that future, which is more regenerative and more relational. And I already have a small manufactured facsimile of that in my own life, right? It's possible, right? And I'm living that way. And, sure. And of course, you know, some would say, well, you know, that you got dealt the privilege card there. True. You know, I have certain privileges, but I think this could be recreated anywhere.
Chris, let me give you an example. You know, for the last 50 years, the American public has literally been under assault by chain stores. Mm-hmm. You know, they have destroyed local economies, especially local commercial economies. And of course, you know, Americans did it. They walked into that gleefully. I remember going to all these permitting hearings for Walmart and other chain stores in the 90s and early 2000s, where there would always be some group of people, you know, with placards saying, "We want bargain shopping, we want bargain shopping." And they turned around and they destroyed their communities by getting it, right? Well, I think that people and listeners ought to be aware that probably that whole chain store economic model is very close to extinction. It's closer to the end of its useful life than to the middle. And one of the things that I take a lot of comfort out of is the idea that there will be tremendous opportunities for young people to rebuild local Main Street economies. You know, and these are going to have to be fine-grained sets of relationships with tremendous numbers of vocational niches and economic niches for people to occupy. Or to reoccupy, or to reinvent, actually, because so much of that matrix of commerce has been destroyed. But I'm convinced that it's coming, and it's going to be, you know, for kids who think that there's nothing more out there for them but some job in a cubicle working for Old Navy's marketing department, you know, they ought to consider, you know, getting into local business, because that's really on the horizon.
Absolutely agree. And I'm wondering, you know, how much of that thinking was part of and came into your World Made by Hand series, which is in many ways taking that thinking and just going further, where you've removed the basic support elements of a of a debt-based economy and abundant energy and refashioned a future that makes sense given those constraints. Let's talk about your most recent installment in that World Made by Hand series.
Yeah, I've pretty much completed the series. I had intended from the beginning to do one book for each season of the year. And so I wrote four of these books. My agenda really was to, first of all, I wanted to sort of depict the conditions that I outlined in the Long Emergency book, you know, a nonfiction book. I wanted to depict them in a way that would get to people through their senses and their emotions, so they could really feel what it might be like to live in that post-industrial, post-petroleum economy, where the internet is no longer a presence, and we no longer rely on computer devices. The electricity is not running anymore. There have been a lot of problems like epidemic diseases, things that we are kind of part of the scene of the converging catastrophes that we face, and what the product of that would be. And so I created this fictional village of Union Grove, in very much like the part of the country that I live in now in upstate New York. And I wanted to inform people that, you know, the human project would continue, that we would be able to find joy in our daily life, although the sources of it might be different than TV and iPhones and Pokemon, and that people would still find love, people would still get over the adversities that they faced, and that also we would kind of return to a lot of things that we'd thrown away in our rush into modernity, and especially into this sort of techno-narcissistic endgame of modernity that we find ourselves in now. So that was the whole idea. In the third volume of the World Made by Hand books, which was called A History of the Future, I kind of opened it up so that we could see what the United States was like, what condition it was in. And my young character, who had gone off into the center of America, discovered that there was a new breakaway nation called the Foxfire Republic, which was my idea of a kind of a tea party fantasy of a right wing authoritarian breakaway nation run by a former country western singer and TV evangelist who I like to describe as Dolly Parton meets Hitler. So the third volume was concerned with that and what happens in that place and what's happened to America. The fourth volume which was called The Harrows of Spring, and it was just published by the Atlantic Monthly Press in July, takes place back in Union Grove, and we're back to the everyday struggles of the folks involved there. And the villains in this story are the social justice warriors who have come over from Great Barrington, Massachusetts, to basically grift money out of my people, and to try to exchange their paper Berkey bucks for the silver that the scarce silver that my people have acquired, you know, in the few years that the post-industrial economy has been over. So I had a lot of fun with that, and in particular because I'm very concerned about this this new rise of Maoism on the campuses, and this whole idea that it's okay to shut down freedom of speech, and the despotic nature of the kind of fake intellectualism that's coming out of the universities right now in our culture. And I think it's terribly dangerous, and I think it needs to be opposed. So,
well, it's not easy to oppose that because there's a buzzsaw involved in that.
It's true. Your reputations are destroyed. Careers are destroyed. I think you and I are fortunate because we don't have to teach in college. We're not dependent on college jobs. We're not concerned about our tenure or losing that position. But there are an awful lot of people who are, and it's had a terrible effect on the intellectual life of our country in the last several years. To some extent, it's kind of destroying it. And so we need to oppose that movement, and we need to get behind freedom of speech and understand that it is okay to talk about things that make us uncomfortable. I think one of the kind of watchwords or watch phrases of the period that we're entering is get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Which is something I do in my own life on purpose, because edges are where growth occurs, and I love to keep growing and changing. I will go further and say that having uncomfortable feelings and experiences and conversations is not just okay. They're essential.
I agree.
They're absolutely essential. So really, a lot of the so-called PC movement to me is about enshrining people's rights to have wounds that they don't want to look at and examine. And then you have to dance around those, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody's saying, oh, there's this thing that makes me feel uncomfortable. So you are now responsible for not bringing that up. That's flipped. That's exactly backwards.
It ensures the failure of development of people from being children to moving into adulthood.
Mm-hmm. I agree. That's been a big part of my adulthood, is owning my own reactions and discovering that when I do have a strong reaction to something, it doesn't mean necessarily that thing is a really bad thing that I should avoid. It means I have something to look at. So separating for me as I get older, learning to separate and parse out the difference between having a reaction to something and having a response to something. I feel like the PC movement pretends they're the same thing and they're not. You can have a reaction that's very different from your response. That's the essence of maturity, at least for me. So I'm a boy, so we develop late anyway. I don't know. But
well, that's true. I think it's been demonstrated that in boys, the part of the brain that controls judgment really doesn't flower until they're about 25 years old. That was true in my case. I was, I do think that your youth is a time when it's okay to flounder around. In fact, if you're going to do floundering in your life, you're better off doing it before you're 25 than doing it, when you're middle-aged or older. And so that's okay. And that was the case for me. It took me quite a while to get to grow up. And finally I understood some things about life, like the fact that I have what I call Kunstler's law of social relations. which is the idea, you can state it this way, that out of any room with 100 people, 99 of them think they're the only ones who don't have their act together.
You know, we're all frauds.
Well, not frauds necessarily, but that we're all insecure. You know, I mean, a lot of young people go out into the world and they think, oh gosh, everybody else is so much more confident than I am. They're all doing so much better than me. You know, they've got that job. I didn't get that job and they have it and they're okay and I'm not okay. But the truth of the matter is that when you really get down to it, just about everybody is insecure, and that's the human condition. And so, you know, with that in mind, we go forward and we try in the best way that we can to overcome the adversities and hardships that we face. And everybody does that too. You know, everybody has a hard time in life. You know, even the people that we envy, even the movie stars, even the gazillionaires, everybody has a hard time one way or another.
Absolutely. So, and maybe the hard times, if we can reframe that and say, without a judgment, saying, oh, it's a bad thing. Because sometimes out of the hard times, you know, that's where you really blossom. You know, some of the most spiritual people had just almost psychotic splits in their background, really awful experiences that led to the flowering of their consciousness. So to me, you know, whether PC is good or bad or right or wrong or all of that, if something is in the service of making us become more conscious, more whole, more engaged, more connected, more alive, I'm in favor of it. And sometimes those things aren't, it's not all rainbows and unicorns and Skittles. You know, sometimes there's some, what we call hard times associated with that development, but growth isn't easy. And that's really what I feel is that you're talking about that, I'm using this word carefully, that retardation of development, or that arrested development. It's almost like enshrining our rights to not grow up. You know, it's like a Peter Pan play being writ out at this point in time. So I'm opposed to that, because I do think that this next period of time is going to really call on us to be as conscious and as developed as we can. And of course, the ability of demagogues and, you know, other unpalatable characters to sort of rise up and play on people's wounds and fears is going to be very large when the economic storm re-arrives in full gale force. And so before then, I think anything anybody can do for themselves, because that's the only thing you can control, to increase your emotional intelligence, increase your emotional maturity, which is fundamentally the process of becoming able to handle and tolerate wider and wider ranges of discomfort. Mm-hmm. Not avoid them, handle wider ranges of them. And so that's been my learning over the past few years. It's really starting to cement for me.
Well, I think it's even applicable on the just the physical level of, you know, there's an idea, which I happen to believe, that, you know, if you expose your body to a certain amount of discomfort, whether it's, you know, the stress of using your muscles or being cold for a certain amount of time in the day, or, you know, in some way pushing yourself to that edge you described, that, you know, that too will help you develop into a stronger person and a healthier person. And of course, that's exactly what we don't see in America, where, you know, comfort and convenience are absolutely the highest values. And we have a whole nation of people sitting on the sofa, you know, scarfing down those cheese doodles, watching the Kardashians on TV. And that's not healthy. So I do think we are going to go to a better place, and that nothing lasts forever, including the deformations of our time. So, and we're going to get there together. Well, I'm going to watch you go through it, and you'll watch me go through it.
Fantastic. And on that positive note, we have been talking with James Howard Kunstler, the author of The Heroes of Spring, the latest fourth installment in the World Made by Hand series. So rush out and get that. It's just a fantastic series. I have it right here on my bookshelf. Jim, thank you so much for your time today.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Chris. I admire what you're doing hugely.
Thank you.